Hello, and welcome to the Comics Ate My Brain Weekly Roundup Podcast. I'm Tom Bondurant, and this week I'll be talking about comics from August 12th, 2009, including Action Comics number 880, Adventure Comics number 1, or Adventure Comics number 504, if you so prefer, Batman number 689, Blackest Night number 2, Blackest Night Batman number 1, Booster Gold number 23, Green Arrow Black Canary number 23, Green Lantern Corps number 39, JSA vs. Cobra number 3, Titans number 16, The Unwritten number 4, and Wednesday Comics number 6. And we begin this week with Green Arrow Black Canary number 23, and I have to say, I think I'm about done with this title. It just isn't doing anything for me. I probably will get the next issue because I have a feeling that's going to wrap up the current storyline. But after that, my budget really just won't allow for it. This month, and the issue was written by Andrew Kreisberg, with penciled by Mike Norton. The first feature was inked by Bill Sienkiewicz, and the co-feature featuring Black Canary was inked by Joe Rubinstein. This issue reintroduces a villain named Big Game. He's got a Kraven thing going on, and he is angry because, that would be a spoiler. At any rate, not a very memorable villain, pretty standard motivation, and Kreisberg and Norton have the sort of compare and contrast layout working for Green Arrow and Big Game, where, you know, they're both looking at a similar scene. Big Game looks at it through the eyes of rage, as it were. A Green Arrow looks at it, you know, another way. And I'm sure that's used effectively in other books, but I'm sorry to say, not in this one. Also, I continue to have an issue with Bill Sienkiewicz inking Mike Norton. I like both of these artists very well, especially as pencilers, but I've never really liked Bill Sienkiewicz as an inker, except when he's inking his own stuff. And when he's inking someone whose lines are really clean, like Norton's, or like when he inked Jim Aparo in the 90s on Batman, it creates a sort of cognitive dissonance for me. So I don't know, if this is the way it's going to be, then it's just in a place where I am not. And that's too bad, because again, I like Mike Norton. Andrew Kreisberg hasn't really done anything bad with these characters, but he hasn't done anything real innovative either, and he's dropped a lot of the Team Arrow stuff that I actually did enjoy when Judd Winnick was on the book. Speaking of which, the second feature stars Black Canary, follows up on her angst from the last issue. Here she talks to Wildcat about, you know, the consequences of using her powers, and that's nice to see, because as you may remember, I felt that she kind of was left in an ambiguous place last issue, maybe an inappropriate place even, and so it's good to see that hadn't gone away. But at the same time, it's kind of like, you know, these are just sort of generic characters. I'm not getting the kind of vibe that I would have hoped for from these characters. Moving on to Titans number 16, which is a spotlight on Starfire, and which actually, it's written by Christopher Yost, before I forget, penciled by Angel Unzueta. I'm sure I've mispronounced one or both of his names. Inked by Wayne Fauscher, or Fauché, again, pronunciation. And in this issue, Starfire is psychoanalyzed. That probably sounds rather cliched, and it kind of is, but it goes to some interesting places, not least of which because it ties Starfire's problems into kind of the larger DC universe, starting with Dick Grayson as Batman, touching on Infinite Crisis, excuse me, not Infinite Crisis, Final Crisis, which maybe people had forgotten about, I don't know. I don't know. I like the art. I think Unzueta and Fosher combined for something that resembles or reminds me of Chris Cross's work, which I like. It's not cartoony, but it's not particularly, it's not a slave to realism either, and that's nice to see. It's distinctive. Starfire, but also kind of a TNA character, and they're actually, I'm flipping through it, there's a lot of TNA, not least because of the design of Starfire's costume. I don't know, I enjoyed the issue. I can't really talk about the character moments without getting into spoilers, but and again, I wasn't a real fan of Christopher Yost on Red Robin, so I wasn't really expecting to like this, but I liked how it portrayed Starfire. It's, the third in these series of one-off Titan solo spotlights, so it may not mean much in the great scheme of things, but it was an enjoyable way to spend 22 pages and $3, I guess. Not a, I know that's not particularly a ringing endorsement, but trust me, I liked it. Next is JSA versus Cobra number 3, written by Eric Troutman, penciled by Don Kramer, and inked by Michael Babinski. And this issue features a lot more of the Justice Society than the first two. It also includes, have I told you about this before? It also includes one of my least favorite conventions in all of present-day superhero comics, which is Dr. Midnight conducting surgery or doing some other medical sciency type stuff in full costume, like with cape. I'm a lawyer. I wear a suit a lot. I don't wear a suit when I'm cooking. I know this is because it gets in the way. It is my uniform, but I don't have to wear it all the time to remind people of what I do. Dr. Midnight has, and again, I don't follow the regular JSA book. I don't know if there's some incontinuity explanation for Dr. Midnight wearing his costume, everywhere. I know Reed Richards wears the FF jumpsuit under his lab coat. But that's Reed, and he's obsessive compulsive about that kind of thing. Dr. Midnight, come on. I mean, it's Dr. Midnight because he can wear the freaking goggles. If there's a dude wearing green goggles and operating, my first guess it's going to be Dr. Midnight. He doesn't need to wear the whole stupid costume. Anyway, I like this issue. I continue to like this series. I like the way that Troutman handles the bulk of the Justice Society beyond Power Girl and Mr. Terrific and Alan Scott. There's a nice two-page spread of the JSA beating up on some Cobra thugs, which I think Kramer and Babinski pull off pretty well. And the meat of the issue once more is Cobra being able to outwit Mr. Terrific. Makes you appreciate that Cobra is really a serious threat, and the Cobra goons are much more dangerous than, say, Hydra or AIM or who would be goons? Oh, HIVE, Hive goons in the DC universe. All around, continuing to enjoy this miniseries. We're at the halfway point, and it feels like it, so I'm hoping that the next issue or two will find Mr. Terrific and Power Girl starting to put things together and beat back some of Cobra's advances. I do have to note, though, that this is just a random thing. Titan 16 and the JSA versus Cobra covers. I kind of had them together because I wanted to mention they both feature female characters sort of thrusting their boobs at the reader. Starfire on the Titans cover and Power Girl on this cover. I don't think it's meant to be a sort of TNA thing, but it's hard not to notice. At any rate, and, you know, probably because I'm a pig as well. Next up, The Unwritten, number 4, written by Mike Carey. I'll never get tired of making that particular inflection. And drawn by Peter Gross. And this issue picks up on the murders in the old Dark House plot from the last issue. It pulls together some of the threads from earlier in the series. Not much earlier, of course, because it hadn't been that long of a series. Includes a pretty clever satire of fan fiction, and ends on a cliffhanger, which is kind of odd because, again, it's purporting to wrap up the first story arc. But, you know, I continue to like it, as with the JSA series. Well, I like it for different reasons than with the JSA series, but this has been an entertaining series overall. We get to see a little bit more of the serial killer in this one, and kind of a Dario Argento vibe I got off the serial killer, in fact. I don't know if that's intentional or not, or if I'm sure Argento draws on some deeper horror convention that Mike Carey knows about and I don't. And that's fine. So, you know, it's a fun series, and I recommend it highly. Now, Adventure Comics number 1/504. I kind of wish it were number 504, but that's just me. I am a slave to tradition. This is the long-awaited return of Superboy. Connor Kent, the post-crisis Superboy, written by Jeff Johns and drawn by Francis Manapul, with the co-feature being Legion of Superheroes, also written by Johns and drawn by Clayton Henry. And we'll get the co-feature nitpick out of the way first. Nothing happens in the co-feature. Nothing happens in the co-feature. Starman gets a burger. He talks to some birds. There is a two-page spread of the Legion of Superheroes, which I know others have pointed out is completely gratuitous in an eight-page feature. And there is a one-page teaser for, you know, coming attractions, which, again, borders on the gratuitous in an eight-page feature. So, essentially, you've wasted, I'm no good with math, but almost half of the story on filler. When most of the people, I suspect, reading this book are going to have read it because they've read Final Crisis Legion of Three Worlds. And they have a pretty good idea of who's in the Legion. And they don't need any more two-page spreads of Legionnaires. Oy. Anyway, so, you know, and Clayton Henry, he's a decent artist. He didn't set my eyes on fire or anything like that in a good way or a bad way. But I'm not going to be reading this book for the Legion feature if it's going to be that superficial. At any rate, the best thing about the Superboy feature is Martha Kent. In the first four pages of the book, Johns and Manapul really do a good job of reminding readers what Martha's been through sort of in the background of all the big Superman-related events. Most notably that she's lost Jonathan Kent, I'm not sure exactly how long ago in comic book time, but sets up a good relationship between her and Connor, which is something that Connor has not really enjoyed And she hasn't really experienced, and neither have any of the other Superman characters. You see Martha kind of as an empty nester, who is really enjoying having Connor around, and Connor similarly is looking to reground himself in the familiar things that he left behind when he was dead. Unfortunately, the rest of the story isn't quite as interesting as all of that. I mean, Francis Manapul turns in some very good art, ably assisted by Brian Buccitello, who's the colorist. Jeff Johns does a decent job of reintroducing Superboy as kind of, I suppose he's a high schooler. He looks a little older than that, trying to follow in the footsteps of Superman and reclaim his old life and flirt with girls along the way, and deal with the fact that he comes from both the DNA of Superman and Lex Luthor. But there's not much more to the story than that, and I know that sounds like a lot, but oh, and the other thing that I appreciated about this story was that it mentioned his early days in the Reign of the Supermen storyline, where he there's a line about when I just came out of that test tube, and taken by itself, that's a pretty that's almost sounds like something the Vision would say. But for someone like me who was first introduced to Superboy in Reign of the Superman and followed him through Young Justice and the Superman titles, where he was a more wacky, light-hearted character, and then kind of saw the, well, maturation, I guess, into this more serious character who Geoff Johns used in Teen Titans and has just brought back. That was a nice way to connect those two eras, and I'm hoping that Johns doesn't forget that there was a lighthearted core to the Superboy character early on, and he's not just, oh, woe is me, I have evil dictator DNA and superpowers. But I have to say, as much as I like the idea of there being an Adventure Comics again, I'm not sure that I'm gonna be around for the next issue, because there just wasn't really anything in this issue to grab me and make me want to come back for issue 505 or issue 2. So, I may be looking at the paperback on that one. Again, nothing against any of the people involved, nothing against the Superboy character, but he's just not working for me anymore. Next up, though, is Action Comics number 880, written by Greg Rucka and James Robinson, penciled by Julian Lopez, and inked by Bit. This is part two of Codename Patriot. It features the Kryptonian assassin from last issue, rocketing to Earth with Superman and Supergirl in hot pursuit. And naturally, the military is paranoid about anything having to do with Kryptonians. So, everybody's on sort of full alert. Action Comics nominally features Nightwing and Flamebird, and so we get to see them as well. But the nice thing about this issue is it sort of pulls everybody together, including the Daily Planet staffers, and especially Lois Lane, Perry White, and Jimmy Olsen, who get to see Superman again. And that's nice. There's a Lois and Clark reunion, and that's handled very well. I enjoyed that. There's also some threads set up, as kind of the cover indicates, about Reactron or maybe Metallo. I'm not sure about those suits on the cover. So it's a good action-packed, no pun intended, issue. Everybody's got a lot of plates spinning, but they all come off pretty well. There is a shocking reveal, which isn't all that shocking the more I think about it. But that's probably the weakest part of the issue, and even that I thought was done, with as much style as Rucka and Robinson and Lopez could muster. The second feature is Captain Atom, written by Rucka and Robinson, and drawn by Cafu, and it picks up on Captain Atom storming the castle, so to speak. Well, not so to speak. He actually does storm the castle, and it becomes even more obvious that he's trapped in some sort of virtual world, or things are not what they seem, because the co-feature ends on a more down-to-earth note. So not much really to say about it because it sort of builds up to that one point. I suppose it's the point of it is to once again show off Cap's powers and show that he really is overmatched against the kind of generic sword and sorcery army that he fights. Next is Booster Gold number 23, and this is the issue with the cover, the photo cover featuring Blair Butler wearing her Booster Gold fan club t-shirt, which I'm told was available at San Diego and can be bought at finer comic shops and probably online as well. And I have to say, if I didn't know that was Blair Butler, host of, I think it's Attack of the Show on G4, which is a cable network that I do not receive, I wouldn't know who it was because she just kind of looks like generic blonde woman. I mean, no offense to Blair Butler, who is a handsome woman, but it's like, okay, handsome blonde woman is wearing a Booster Gold t-shirt. And to their credit, Dan Jurgens, who wrote and penciled the issue, and Norm Ratman, who inked it, managed to work the t-shirt into the ongoing storyline about Booster protecting Dick Grayson through the time stream and having to deal with a storyline in which Trigon, the old New Teen Titans villain, takes over the Earth and kills pretty much all of the A-listers of the Justice League. And that's a really, I mean, it's a really good issue, I thought. The big drawback about Booster Gold is that every issue, every subplot, or excuse me, every storyline has to deal with here is some cataclysmic event in the time stream. Leslie Tompkins dies, and therefore, Darkseid conquers the Earth in 15 years. Or every storyline has the potential to boil down to X dies, therefore cataclysmic event Z happens. And Booster has to save. Booster, of course, at first does not save X, so we get to see cataclysmic event Z. Then he goes back, he fixes everything. Every storyline has the potential to end with Booster hitting the reset button. And there is a certain perverse thrill, I think, in seeing all these cataclysmic storylines, and especially this one, because Trigon as a villain, the first Trigon storyline in New Teen Titans, if I can be allowed to digress here for a minute, I thought worked exceptionally well because Raven forms the Titans because the Justice League flat out turns her down. The Justice League and Zatanna specifically, who actually shows up in this issue, which is a nice touch. Zatanna says, "We can't trust this girl, because I sense tremendous evil in her. And at the end of New Teen Titans, Volume 1, Number 4, which is one of my all-time favorite issues of any comic book series, Robin tells off Batman and says, "You big shots blew it." I think in pretty much those terms, Robin says, "Here's what these guys were trying to do, and you guys screwed up, and we Titans would have gotten it right if not for you meddling adults." He doesn't use those terms, but you know, I'm sure a self-aware writer, a Generation X writer like myself, would have made the Scooby-Doo parallel explicit, as I just did. So it sets the stakes, and of course the comeback to that is the cliffhanger for that particular issue is Batman says, "Well, ha ha, you little punk. We are the JLA, and we had it right all along because your girl Raven is no she doesn't have clean hands herself." But anyway, the point of what I'm trying to say is Trigon is a legitimate threat to all creation, and the first New Teen Titans storyline sets that up specifically to say that the Titans are the only group which can stop them, which can stop Trigon, and here specifically is why the JLA does not. So Jurgens kind of takes that a step further and says, if the Titans are destroyed in issue 2 before they face Trigon in earnest, then yeah, the Justice League might stop Trigon early on, but he'll come back and he will eventually prevail because the Titans are not there. So that's what this issue is about, and I thought it was, you know, as repetitive as horrible alternate timelines can get, and as much as Booster Gold sort of walks the fine line between clever plots and naked emotional manipulation through, you know, these alternate timelines. I thought this was an excellent example of an alternate timeline being used effectively. I mean, this is the kind of thing that the book does well. All I'm saying is it can't afford to do too much of this same thing. Unless it keeps doing it well, in which case it could do it forever. And if that made sense, well, it was an accident. The co-feature in Booster number 23 is Blue Beetle, written by Matthew Sturgis, penciled by Mike Norton, and inked by Sandra Hope. And I talked about this one a little in the Grumpy Old Fan column on Thursday. It hinges on kind of a, what I call it, a James T. Kirk-esque, you know, this is what emotions mean moment from one of Jaime's friends. And she basically unburdens herself to the killer robot, or killer cyborg, rather. No, it's a robot. Well, whatever it is. Hair splitting. She unburdens herself to the villains, let's say that. And at that point, it's like, well, that's a nice character moment. But I was more concerned as a casual Blue Beetle reader with fighting the killer cyborgs, androids, whatever they are. So I appreciated the fact that it worked on a couple of levels. It made me want to go back and catch up on Blue Beetle through the paperbacks. But hey, here's a story that's penciled by Mike Norton in a book that I'm not going to be dropping, so that makes me feel a little bit better about the Green Arrow decision. Ha ha ha. Next is Batman number 689. For those of you who are counting, this would be exactly a year, assuming that the issues continue to come out monthly, before Batman 700. Anyhow, it is written by Judd Winnick, penciled by Mark Bagley, and inked by Rob Hunter. It's the second part of Winnick's four-part introductory storyline. Tony Daniel then comes on for six issues, and I'm happy to say that Winnick comes back after that. So maybe Winnick will usher in Batman 700, and we'll have a nice lead up, which I'm hoping starts with this storyline. And it's a pretty decent storyline. It involves Two-Face, the Penguin, the proverbial shadowy figure working behind the scenes, and somebody who's actually out to get Batman, Dick Grayson. And it's Dick, therefore, dealing with sort of being Batman full time, and the very obvious ways in which he is different from Bruce Wayne. These are made clear not just with his dealings with Alfred and with Damian, but sort of him in the Batmobile fighting fires and saving lives, him breaking up speakeasies and smiling on camera, which everybody says Batman does not smile, and sort of playing at being Batman, which, as I said with regard to the Batman and Robin number two, where Grant Morrison makes this conceit pretty clear as well, Dick can only play at being Batman. Because Bruce is Batman. And so the difference is Dick is a performer and he's going to bring a lot more showmanship to the role than Bruce does. And I've argued at length before that all Batman is showmanship. But I think with this different perspective on it, with Dick's perspective, you get the feeling that with Dick, the showmanship kind of takes over. And with Bruce, the showmanship is just sort of a byproduct. Anyway, the issue itself, I thought moved along pretty well. There's a lot of people in here to keep track of, besides Penguin and Batman and Two-Face and Alfred. It reads pretty much like the second issue of a four-part storyline. It has a couple of good action sequences in it, which I think Bagley and Hunter handled admirably. And as I said, it's going to be tough to follow Winnick and Bagley. I'm not entirely convinced that Tony Daniel can do it, but we'll wait and see. Next is Blackest Night, Batman number one. Written by Peter Tomasi, penciled by Ardian Siaf, and inked by John Dell and Vicente Cifuentes. It's actually kind of a dead man storyline. If you've been reading Blackest Night, you know there's that panel where Dead Man is freaking out because his body wants to rise as a black lantern, but of course his spirit has been empowered by Ramakrishna, and that's his whole gig, is that he's a ghost who inhabits other people. And so most of the issue is Dead Man leaping into Batman, expecting to find Bruce Wayne, which is kind of funny, and then Damian as Robin freaking out because Dead Man's inside Dick. And then Dead Man leaping into Robin, and hilarity ensues from there. It is all a lot of setup with a couple of. It's basically a plot that is held together by its moments. There is a scene where a group of dead Batman villains is turned into black lanterns, and, you know, it is what it is. The last page of the book has a pretty striking image involving the bat signal, which is actually very creepy. And unfortunately, that's one of the few highlights of the book. I mean, it's competently done. I've had a problem with Peter Tomasi writing Nightwing and tending to go off into sort of half fanfic dialogue and half expositional. And this is not as bad as his. Yes, I know he's done bad work on Nightwing. Well, not bad, but he's done sort of indulgent work on Nightwing before. And here it is not that bad, but it's not particularly memorable either. And the art is fine. You know, again, the central problem seems to center around Deadman, so I don't know why they didn't call it Blackest Night. Well, I do know why they didn't call it Blackest Night Deadman. They'd rather call it Blackest Night Batman. And I suppose before it is all over, we will have it'll justify being a Batman miniseries, but for now, not so much. Before we get to Blackest Night number 2, I do want to mention Wednesday Comics number 6. And just kind of in passing, because as always, my feelings about the various features are pretty much crystallized. Except the Wonder Woman feature, I thought was actually, I enjoyed it this week. It brings in Etta Candy, and it's not as inscrutable, let's say, as the rest of the Wonder Woman strips have been. And we're in the home stretch here, folks. Blackest Night, or excuse me, Green Lantern Corps number 39, essentially brings every other Green Lantern in the universe up to speed on what people who've been reading Blackest Night already know. So in that respect, it's kind of annoying. Oh, by the way, it was also written by Peter Tomasi, penciled by Patrick Gleason, and inked by Rebecca Buckman and Tom Nguyen. And it, too, is essentially a collection of subplots, sort of hung on a loose organizational structure. Again, it didn't tell us anything really that we didn't already know or couldn't otherwise have figured out, except that it checks in on Daxam, where Aresia, is sort of mourning the incapacitation of Sodom Yat, and it checks in with Crib, the Yellow Lantern, being separated from the children she's abducted, and that's kind of creepy. You know, Crib's always creepy, I suppose, especially for those of us with young children. That's right, la 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 la. Yeah, for those of you who may not be able to hear, you know, Olivia's here watching me. So, you know, one of these days I'm going to sit down and read a whole big chunk of Green Lantern Corps, and I'm sure it'll make more sense in context, but for now, just kind of there. And finally, Blackest Night number 2, written by Geoff Johns, penciled by Ivan Reis, inked by Eau Claire Albert. Once again, this issue picks up with Hal Jordan and Barry Allen fighting the Martian Manhunter. We get to meet a whole lot of other Black Lantern Justice Leaguers, as well as Black Lantern Aquaman, Black Lantern the Spectre, if that makes sense, Black Lantern Pariah, and a handful of others, which I'm sure are interesting primarily to longtime DC readers. This issue continues to build the sort of zombie inevitability, I guess, motif that, you know, the whole world is circling the drain and there's nothing that anybody can do about it, which, of course, is not uncommon to superhero stories, especially big event superhero stories. And there are a few moments in it which really are very unsettling, Black Lantern Spectre being probably the biggest one for me, no pun intended if you've seen the issue. But it kind of feels, again, like, no pun intended, like overkill, given that, you know, the Black Lantern rings are pretty efficient at what they do, which naturally is turning dead superheroes into reanimated killing machines. So for in that respect, the issue feels like it's kind of piling on. There is, you know, the centerpiece, I suppose, of the issue, or the through plot is Barry and Hal's fight with Black Lantern John Jones and the prospect of a Black Lantern Justice League, which again, it feels like piling on because, I mean, the Black Lanterns all seem to be at pretty much the same power level, you know, kind of scary, inevitable power level. So the fact that they're Justice Leaguers doesn't carry any more emotional heft at this point. But the what I've been trying to say is the Barry and Hal versus John Jones fight is handled pretty well. I have the usual caveats about John's scripting, his reliance on first-person narrative captions, his sort of matter-of-fact exposition woven into dialogue. But other than that, it's a decent second issue. It doesn't really set the world on fire, but it does continue, like I say, to build up this mood. So with that, we'll bring this installment of the podcast to a close. Thank you for listening, and I will talk to you next week.